This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These are folks who really get it, and they're committed to it, and they're going to come to work every day, not just thinking about what's right in front of them, but how they can be a real team to promote climate action.
Which of the Trump-era environmental transgressions made your heart hurt the most? Was it when they loosened CO2 emission restrictions on power plants, removed protections from wetlands, or expanded drilling in all sorts of delicate ecosystems? Or perhaps it was the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Change Agreement that wounded you most deeply. It's hard to choose, really. But chin up, there's a new sheriff in town. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Derek Walker, the VP for U.S. Climate at the Environmental Defense Fund, about what we can expect from the new Biden administration. We talk about specific environmental policies, some of the heads of key environmental agencies, and the importance of the U.S. rejoining the Paris Agreement. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Derek Walker. He's a vice president for U.S. climate at the Environmental Defense Fund, the EDF. Derek, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be with you, Alex. Thanks.
So as we turn the page on the Trump administration and look to a new day in terms of environmentalism, what do you think are at the top of your wish list, the EDF wish list, in terms of what the U.S. must do to tackle the threat of climate change?
We have to really just return it to playing a central role in our understanding of what the priorities are for both domestic action and for our role on the global stage. That is the fundamental thing related to climate. That's the fundamental dimension of the climate issue that the previous administration completely abandoned. And so partially what we have to do is we have to restore what we lost. We lost 4 years. Let's be honest about it. We have to restore what we lost over 4 years, but we also need to demonstrate an understanding of the world as it is in 2021, where there are more severe climate impacts that are more costly, that are having more cross-cutting impacts across society and across the world. And so far, President Biden has shown that he is very serious about making climate change an all of government effort.
So the first week has been very encouraging. Just on day one, the Biden administration announced it's rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. Why don't you recap what that means and the logistics of that, how we rejoin it, and maybe some other important first steps that have been taken in this early stage?
Well, getting back in the Paris Agreement is something that was a hallmark of the president's campaign and something that enjoys incredibly broad support in the country. It's going to mean a couple things. One, it's going to propel domestic ambition because it's going to unite the country around an understanding of what the U.S. needs to do to get to an ambitious emissions reduction target, hopefully, both in 2030 and in 2050, but also on the in terms of our relationships with other countries, both our allies and those that we need to rebuild relationships with. It's a calling card for understanding that there's common purpose and a belief that the global that climate change is fundamentally a global issue that involves shared responsibility. And it's going to require not only the diplomacy by Secretary Kerry and the many others who will be representing the administration. It's also going to require Congress and the president's cabinet and advisors really implementing strong domestic policies so that we can be on that emissions trajectory.
Yes, John Kerry was the nation's top diplomat, a Secretary of State under Barack Obama, and he's also, you know, a longtime serving senator and ran for president famously. Why don't you give a glimpse into whether he can become kind of our next Al Gore? He's the climate czar. What do you hope that he can achieve? And maybe give us a glimpse into his mindset as he approaches this new position.
Well, just putting someone with that much experience and deep respect, both at home and abroad, into a role like that of the climate envoy is a signal that climate change is going to be at the center of the administration's domestic and global agenda. I think that the secretary is very much of the mindset that the U.S. can be a force for positive change on the climate issue if we show up in a much different way than how we have in the last 4 years. And also that the climate crisis is really integrated into the agenda of all parts of government. The fact that John Kerry has a position on the National Security Council really underscores the fact that climate is not just an issue about protecting the environment, but it's an issue about national security. It's an issue about trade. It's an issue that impacts our ability to engage effectively, both with allies and adversaries across the world. And so, unlike Vice President Gore, Vice President Gore was in many ways ahead of his time. He was maybe the climate czar when he was vice president, but there weren't exactly a lot of other partners in government at that time. John Kerry comes in here with a robust team across government, you know, from Gina McCarthy, Michael Regan, Deb Haaland. These are all folks who are seasoned leaders on climate, and seasoned, but also they're going to center climate as not only an urgent imperative to protect the health and well-being of the planet, but also as something that can be a driver of economic growth.
So this is the first time that a climate czar has been on the National Security Council, correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And it's also the first time that we've had a climate envoy with the deep reputation and visibility and credibility that Secretary Kerry has. We've had a lot of really strong diplomats in those positions, but we've never had someone who, you know, was a presidential nominee and a longtime senator and a extremely well-respected member of the cabinet in a previous administration. It's unprecedented, and it really shows the seriousness and the competency that that the president and vice president are looking to bring to some of these key roles.
I guess the best sign is that they've put such stock in putting like a John Kerry in this position along with some of the other pieces of the puzzle. You mentioned Michael Regan, the new head of the EPA, and the new Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland. Can you give us a little bit more of an idea about what they're all about?
Yeah, so Administrator nominee Regan was a longtime colleague of mine at Environmental Defense Fund and took over the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality at a really precarious point in its history where budget and morale were suffering. And he's really helped bring that agency together as well as achieve some really great wins. And I think when you said that the president and vice president are really into building consensus, I think that's really been a hallmark of Michael's career also. And I think that in Congresswoman Haaland, nominee Haaland, you have someone who not only has a longtime commitment to health and environmental protection, who's been very supportive of rules to prevent methane from having the dangerous impact that it has on the planet from the oil and gas industry. She's been a huge supporter of that, but also is the first Native American to serve in a presidential cabinet when she's confirmed. You know, she brings an entirely new and important and well overdue perspective on the importance of the stewardship of our land and the cultural significance and the ecological significance and the importance in that context of not just our public lands as a place where you can achieve significant emissions reductions and climate benefits, but really a place where our public lands are really the front lines of resilience against climate impacts. And I think that the secretary-to-be is going to be a great leader on that. I think there are a number of other nominees out there in different for different positions who also have centered climate in their careers and in their agendas, even if they're not in roles that have climate in the title in the Biden administration. I think you're going to see them be huge advocates. And I'm just super excited about that.
You know a lot more about how the sausage is made in the policymaking world. What names come to mind?
Well, let's just pick Brian Deese as an example. He's going to be the head of the National Economic Council, and he was the climate wizard, one of a handful of really really tenacious leaders in the Obama administration that helped forge some of the progress that we made. Not only on climate issues, but he was behind the one of the folks who was behind the auto bailout, which has had such a significant impact in revitalizing the U.S. auto industry. Janet Yellen, has Secretary of Treasury, has been a big supporter of a carbon tax and the importance of making sure that we understand the risks, the economic and financial risks associated with climate change. Secretary Buttigieg ran for president on a really strong climate platform.
Yes, we don't usually think of Secretary of Transportation as an environmental issue, but
no,
it absolutely
sure
is, right? And he's making that quite clear from his initial messaging.
You sure don't, but it's huge. It's huge. Transportation is the largest source of emissions in our country, even more than power generation. And the opportunities on light and medium duty vehicles, but especially on heavy duty trucks, which use so much gasoline and produce so much dangerous pollution that disproportionately impacts low income communities and communities of color. And then when you combine that with the importance of mass transit and the infrastructure there that has been decimated because of the pandemic, I think Secretary Buttigieg is going to be a great pick for that, and really, across government, you hear it time and time again that that this is going to be an all of government effort by the new president. He's got Ali Zaidi as Gina McCarthy's deputy. Ali has been instrumental in a number of posts within his career, both in the Obama administration, but then most recently with Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York. These are folks who really get it, and they're committed to it, and they're going to come to work every day, not just thinking about what's right in front of them, but how they can be a real team to promote climate action.
Listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace. Just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to the Vice President for U.S. Climate at EDF Action, the Environmental Defense Fund, Derek Walker. So, Derek, we were talking about some of the new pieces in the Biden administration that will affect change. How are things going to be different? They have to do a complete 180 after trying to limit the damage that the previous EPA administrators and the secretaries of the interior wrought on our nation's resources.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a big challenge, and it's really an unfortunate fact that we not only lost 4 years, but we went backwards. And so just on day one, you saw the intention to restore the CAR standards and the methane rules that really address pollution from the oil and gas industry. The couple days ago, actually, before the president was inaugurated, a court struck down the effort that the Trump administration had made to produce a regulation for the power industry that would actually increase pollution rather than decrease it.
Was it called like the Clean Air and Water Act or something?
Oh, yeah, of course, it had a very beautiful euphemistic name. But the bottom line is that we understand that there are major sources of pollution that really undermine the health and well-being of all Americans and communities across the country. And those are the very first areas that the new administration has said that they're going to tackle. So that's one thing. The second thing is, from a congressional standpoint, you now have the ability, even though you have a divided chamber in the Senate, you now have the critical ability to determine what makes it on the floor and what kinds of issues are put before the committees. That really, in some ways, makes all the difference, because the climate issues and ambitious climate action are overwhelmingly popular in the country.
Right.
And what you saw in 2018, or really in 2019 and 2020, over on the House side, was a huge spike in the attention that climate and energy and clean energy innovation got through congressional hearings, through the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. And so now we go from being in the passenger seat without any real access to the wheel to now having the ability to steer the agenda of what the Congress is actually thinking about and talking about. And that's not the same thing as getting stuff done. This is a real opportunity to work, I think, not just across the aisle, but across constituencies and demographics in this country to build solutions that are durable and that work for people. We have never had a real strong set of climate policies at the federal level that bring agriculture and forestry to the table in a positive, you know, way, where there's win-win solutions. We have real issues in the past with the way that coal workers and fossil fuel workers writ large have felt understandably very vulnerable because of the transition that is underway as solar and wind and batteries become so much cheaper, the transition away from fossil fuels, which at this point is really inevitable, even just based on market forces, and certainly an important transition for the climate. But we need to protect the workers and the communities that have relied on the industries that will kind of soon be the industries of the past. We need to protect them and have a bridge to the future, which not only includes benefits, but also jobs and economic development and community investment. And I think that in a divided House and Senate, which is pretty much divided in both the House and the Senate at this point, you really need to focus on the nexus between economic growth and recovery and taking climate as an increasingly serious national priority. And there's a record there of climate action. It creates, it can create a lot of jobs. It can propel economic growth. It can put people to work locally, especially when you think about renewable energy installation, energy efficiency, building retrofits. There's a lot of opportunities to do that. And those are things that are far less partisan than they have often been portrayed to be. And I think that working in a 50-50, essentially, House and Senate, we're going to need to lift those things up. the economic opportunities around climate action. We just have to lift them up a little bit more.
Derek, just from a pure messaging standpoint, it seems that I think you'll agree that like over the last 30, 40 years, the messaging from the party of pollution would be that jobs and big business are mutually exclusive from protecting our natural resources. And I think over the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen the progressive movement kind of counter with the allure of green jobs. Is there a third messaging arrow in the progressive quiver? What would be some of the more effective political messaging tools of attacking that very effective messaging that the Republicans have had for so many years?
It has been disturbingly effective at times, but I think that what also has been effective is the growth of the clean energy industry in places like China and the EU, who have had a much more open-minded view of the importance of building out their clean energy industries. And in many ways, that's why we've seen the loss of jobs and industries and whole sectors at times.
But I don't mean just the clean energy as much as if you can stand for a half hour of listening to Fox News talk about business, it's going to be about anti-regulation. That's what Donald Trump is touting as his greatest achievement in some people's eyes. We know that is not true, you and I. But how can that effectively be chewed away into the psyche of the American voter rather than just offering other types of jobs?
Well, part of it is by focusing on the importance of regulations as a tool for protecting people's health and well-being. I think that connection needs to be deepened at every turn. And I think that the advocacy community has increasingly warmed up to that in the last decade, and that's become an effective message. I also think that the way that the anti-regulatory groups like to frame it is that it's an either-or kind of binary choice between having jobs and having economic growth and being really serious about environmental protection. And if you look at places that have been environmental leaders, California is one. In Europe, you certainly have, Germany has been a huge leader on environmental issues. And even China, with some of their incentives in past years for both on buildings and on renewable energy, they're seeing economic growth because of, not in spite of, the environmental policies. And I think in a lot of ways in this country, the economy has been decimated. Even before the pandemic, we had been losing jobs in the fossil fuel industry and seeing, much faster growth in the clean energy sector than we had in other parts of the economy. And those are jobs that, look very different in different parts of the country, but they can be everywhere, whether it's transmission and distribution systems, whether it's retooling manufacturing facilities so that they can, begin producing components for, wind turbines or for batteries. There's the potential to rebuild with jobs that are within the existing footprint of American industry by and large. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities there. And I think that another way to counter this, frankly, is that just yesterday, you saw the Chamber of Commerce and the Edison Electric Institute and the American Petroleum Institute, three titans of influence industry groups, come out and say that getting in the Paris Agreement was good for the country, good for the economy, that it's important to do things like control methane because it has such a bad impact on global warming. I mean, these are bedrock, conservative, pro-industry, anti-regulatory institutions that have been around forever and have a real voice and real influence in Congress and in states around the country, saying that, wait a minute, it's kind of a new day. We're maybe not all the way where, an environmental group might want them to be, but man, they've made a lot of progress in thinking about climate climate action as a win-win. And I think that's going to resonate with decision makers as they think about what's politically possible.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Derek Walker. He's a vice president for the Environmental Defense Fund. Are there any Supreme Court cases that we need to be kind of monitoring? What kind of poison pills did the Trump administration leave for environmentalists to kind of wring their hands over during this early period of change?
Well, the biggest challenge is really going to be that the courts has shifted so much in the direction of anti-regulatory interpretation, and the three nominees or the three justices that the Trump administration put on the court don't have a sterling record of support for environmental issues. I actually think that the Massachusetts versus EPA decision in 2007, which affirms the ability of the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases, is a public health concern and to protect Americans. You know, that is the bedrock environmental law, protecting the ability of government to do a lot of these things we're talking about. And what I think is really important is an acknowledgement of the fact that we have a much more conservative judiciary than we had 4 years ago, is that we don't go well beyond established precedent under some of these previous decisions, that we take a more conservative, small c conservative approach to what kinds of regulatory actions we as advocates encourage the government to take, so that we're not getting out there and offering up regulations or administrative decisions that are suspect. I mean, I think that, you know, there is a swath of entities on the right that are simply going to challenge and cast aspersions on virtually anything that's meant to protect the environment and public health, and that's a given. But the more that we can avoid creative and Byzantine interpretations of existing law to try to be, you know, even more ambitious than we know we can be, I think that'll protect us a little bit from the judiciary. But we have to be very vigilant about it, and we are not done with fighting in the courts. And I think that, it's very, very important to have folks who have been in government for a long time thinking about what they can do, again, within established existing authority. And that's what I expect to see.
He's the VP for Climate Action at the Environmental Defense Fund, Derek Walker. Derek, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure, Alex. You have a great day.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by O'Donnell Levy and Fog Swamp. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.